Our next guest, before we get into the next guest, you know, there's he's going to be talking about ethical oil and the Alberta oil sands. There was a major event here that took place in Canada today. The federal government rejected on environmental grounds the permit to allow a huge mining operation to open up in British Columbia. The company behind it has spent $100 million over 17 years to try to get the project to go ahead. Had passed all the hurdles at the provincial government level, but the federal government turned down the Prosperity gold and copper mine in central British Columbia. It would have created 700 jobs. And the BC Minister of State for Mining Development said something. He was pretty upset with this. Said something today that I thought was, wow, I haven't heard a politician speak like this in a long time. And I'm going to try to do some more research on this and maybe write something on it. He said that when you talk about the environment, you shouldn't just talk about the environment that you the rocks and the trees and things like that. You have to look at the whole environment. You have to look at the social environment, and you have to look at the economic environment as well, trying to redefine what environment means. And I thought, well, good for him, because when you talk about environment from a point of view of the economy and social structure and social benefits, you are de facto including humans in the environment. And I know you've got a problem with this, Carrie.
What thought came to my mind as you're talking about this, because I'm familiar with this project, and it would have been a real boost to the economy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I live on acreage, Terry.
Yeah.
And you know what? My acreage is constantly changing. The environment, the water, the weather, all factors into it. Just on my way out here tonight, I thought, boy, I've got to move some dirt because the waterway drains has shifted and now created different issues.
Yeah.
I'm always changing the environment to facilitate stability and what's in the interest of what I sustain on my property.
You know, here's one of my greatest regrets. During the campaign when I ran for city council in Coquitlam, I was asked, as everybody was asked, what have you done for the environment? And I came up with some BS answer, not really answering the question.
I hang out with Carrie Simpson.
And what I should have answered was,
salmon are sacred.
Ask not what you can do for the environment, but ask what the environment can do for you.
Okay.
Okay? That's what I should have said.
That would have been brilliant.
And I think Hawes is getting to that point.
You should give him that line. As long as he gives you credit for it, right?
Anyway, I hope to talk to him in the next 2 or 3 days. Anyway, so while we're on this topic of, and this is a purposeful segue.
We're not talking stop it, we're talking topic.
Topic. Yeah. Purposeful segue into the topic of natural resources, environmental protection, and economic and social environment, not just natural environment. We are pleased to bring the listeners of Roadkill Radio one of our favorite sons, Ezra Levant, the author of Ethical Oil, the columnist for the Sun newspaper chains, and the soon-to-be TV host, Ezra Levant, on the line right now. Hi, Ezra.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Just great, thank you.
Welcome, our son.
not our prodigal son, one of our favorite sons. Oh, you're prodigal. You're going around the country.
Come on, let's give him credit.
You know what? I tell you, this guy is putting more air miles on these days, promoting his book, Ethical Oil. Is it because it's a real hard sell, Ezra, that you have to keep flying across the country to try to get somebody to buy one or two books?
Logging it away.
Is that the problem, Ezra, that nobody just wants to hear about this and you have to just
make them hear about it?
Is that what's going on?
Well, you know, I think it always helps to be there in person if you want people to pay attention to the book. I mean, I've done a ton of interviews on TV, radio, and in the newspapers, but, you know, I've hit Chapters stores or other bookstores literally from Victoria to St. John's, and I'm going up to Fort McMurray soon, which will be great. That'll feel like a homecoming. Look, this book is totally different.
You'll be a hero.
That's right.
This book is a departure for me. It's a liberal book. I made the liberal case for the oil sands. I'm conservative, I'm a right-wing guy, so if you would ask me what I believe about the environment, I would say things like, well, I believe in property rights, I'm a skeptic about man-made global warming, I I think it's a, you know, I would give a conservative answer that would please a lot of right-wingers, but it actually wouldn't convince a lot of liberal skeptics.
Okay.
And that's the problem right now is most critics of the oil sands, I would call them liberal, but I don't think they're malicious or evil or hostile. I think they're just, it's just a blend of lack of information, some misinformation, and not asking the right questions. And for example, when Bed Bath & Beyond or Whole Foods or The Gap or some companies like that announce that they're going to boycott oil sands oil because they don't think it meets their ethical standards, pardon me, that sounds like a really liberal thing to do, or, you know, sort of a self-righteous feel-good thing. And a lot of liberals would probably say, yeah, right on. But you could bash them for it, or you could simply say, okay, where do you want to buy your oil from, guys? If oil sands oil from Canada is not ethically appropriate for you, where are you going to get it from? And I actually don't think anyone's asking that question, because I don't. If they would think it through, they'd say, okay, well, we can't fill up our cars with gas made in Canada. Well, where's it going to come from? If you look at the list of countries that export oil to the United States, they're pretty much all bad guys. I mean, Saudi Arabia was number one until we pushed them out of the top spot, so Saudi Arabia. There's Venezuela, there's Nigeria. I mean, these are not good countries. Mm. And if you look at the list of countries, the top 10 countries ranked by oil reserves in the world, it's even worse. Iran is on there. I'm not sure if Sudan is off the top of my head, but Russia is on there. I mean, they're not a liberal democracy. Mm. Really, the only other liberal democracy on the list is Iraq. Then they're sort of wobbly.
Yes, sort of, yes.
Yeah. So you think?
So that's
we're the only good guys.
So that's a central thesis of your book, hence Ethical Oil. You're saying that despite all the bad publicity and the campaigns that are being mounted against the Alberta oil sands, that it is actually our most ethical choice.
Well, and how do I measure ethics? I come up with four liberal yardsticks, and let me just rattle them off, and you tell me if these sound like real liberal values or a caricature. I think they're real. The first one is the environment, including carbon dioxide. Now, when I was a kid, carbon dioxide was called plant food. We learned about it when we studied photosynthesis, but these days carbon dioxide is called pollution. Fine. So that's the first thing liberals care about is the environment. Don't make a mess. And carbon dioxide, don't heat the world up. Okay, so that's value number one. The second liberal value is peace. That makes sense. I mean, that's the whole peace movement. That's half the word Greenpeace. Liberals believe in peace. Liberals believe in a fair wage for the working man. Call it economic justice, if you like. I mean, that's the whole labor union movement, right? And then finally, liberals believe in human rights, treating minorities right, respect for gays, Aboriginals, women. So those are my four liberal yardsticks. And, you know, when I say these to real liberals, they nod. They say, yeah, that's me. You're talking about me. Now, conservatives can believe in those things, too. We just phrase it a little differently. But then I say, okay, if you agree with me that those four yardsticks I've just outlined, environmentalism, peace, economic justice, and human rights, are liberal values, let's go around the world now and compare how Canada's oil sands meets these four tests versus Saudi Arabia, Iran, Sudan, Nigeria, Venezuela, countries like that. And every single country in the world is inferior to us ethically, except for Norway, which is a moderate-sized producer, but they're running out of oil. They're running out of reserves. Their production is declining 10% a year. That's why they're investing in the oil sands. So other than North Sea oil, pretty much oil is pumped by the bastards of the world.
And stop here. You mentioned Norway running out of oil.
Here I was getting almost my rose-colored glasses. I was being romanticized here for a moment, you know?
Sorry, Perry.
Well, no, isn't that a romantic notion?
Here.
Yeah. Well, but that's what he's talked about. The liberal environmental. They're based on these romantic notions as opposed to the realities of the world.
Well, that's the thing is reality, and that's the key thing you've got to tell liberals when you're trying to convince them of the oil sands. Because if you let Greenpeace have their way with your liberal friends, Greenpeace will say, no, we've got to get off oil and have a post-fossil fuel future where it's all solar power and wind power and other technologies that haven't been invented yet. And in 30 to 40 years, we should reduce fossil fuel use, yada, yada, yada. And you've got to interrupt that Greenpeace fundraiser and say, okay, buddy, in 30 or 40 years, we might invent some fantasy fuel of the future, like dilithium crystals or whatever, that has no environmental side effects, that's affordable, and that's practical, and everyone can use. Okay, maybe, but if we shut down the oil sands today, 300 million Americans have to fill up their car with gas from somewhere. And last year in China, for the first time ever, more people bought cars than in America, and they all want to be two-car families in China, and same in India. So as long as people in the world are buying cars and using gas, having a solar-powered or a wind-powered alternative is not being grown up. That's not a sober-minded discussion. That's a discussion for a science fiction convention or something. But if you want to be morally serious, the choice is not oil sands oil versus perfection. It's oil sands oil versus Saudi oil.
Yeah.
Let's just rattle through those four criteria just for one second.
Sure.
The environment. It's almost ridiculous to compare. They don't even have environmental regulations in many of these OPEC countries. There's 2,000 unremediated toxic oil spills in Nigeria. No one's ever going to clean them up. In Canada, we're not allowed to flare gas. In places like Nigeria and Iraq, they just flare billions of dollars worth of natural gas a year. We have to reclaim the open pit mines in the oil sands. They don't do that even in other parts of Canada. That's a myth right there. People think, oh, the oil sands, it's the size of Florida, and it's all going to be dug up in an open pit mine. Actually, only 2% of the oil sands is the oil sands shallow enough that you can get at it through mining. Most of it, you actually have to pump it out of the ground through an in-situ process, so it doesn't rip up the top. But that was ugly, ugly pictures of the open pit mines. I call it oil sands pornography because it's so shocking, but that's what raises money for Greenpeace. Anyways, let me just make one more comparison on this first value of environmentalism. We're better in all the traditional measures, but even in carbon dioxide and energy use, over the last 20 years, the average barrel of oil sands oil has fallen by 38% the amount of CO2 emitted to produce it. We're 38% more efficient, 38% cleaner now than we were in 1990. I can hardly wait to see how much better we are 10 years from now. We're actually better than oil from Nigeria or Iraq because of all the natural gas they flare, or even oil from California, which is called California heavy. It's so viscous. So here's the key way I argue. If someone really, really, really believes in global warming so much that it's almost a religion for them, a right-winger would laugh at them and say, oh, you're part of a cult. But that's not going to convince them. That's just going to insult them. The liberal case for the oil sands would say, okay, you say you believe in man-made global warming? I'm counting on you because I can prove to you using independent sources that oil from Nigeria and Venezuela and Iraq and California even has more CO2 per barrel than oil from the oil sands. So shouldn't we replace those higher carbon sources of oil with our lower carbon oil sands oil? And if you can prove it, which I do, that our oil sands oil has a lower carbon footprint than oil from those four other sources I just listed, if you're really worried about global warming, you should switch to oil sands oil.
Ezra,
that's
you're
actually going to persuade someone.
Yeah, Ezra, you're being incredibly logical here.
I was going to say logical
Very
and realistic.
Logical, realistic, eminently understandable, reasonable again. And you know what? And I'm looking at some of the hardcore American-funded environmentalists. And by the way, last week, Ezra, on our show, we had Vivian Krause, the great Vancouver researcher who has traced all of the money, roots from the great American foundations through the Tide, Tide Foundation in the U.S. and in Canada, into all the activist groups aiming at the oil sands. I don't know if you've met Vivian Krause.
I read that, just an outstanding piece of investigative journalism.
That's great.
You're so right. And let me clarify. When I say these arguments are useful for talking about liberals, I mean true idealistic liberals. In my mind, I imagine a 20-something-year-old student at McGill, probably enrolled in vegetarian studies, reads the papers and hears bad things about the oil sands, but is not malicious or evil.
No, just
misguided. You'll never convince someone who's a paid hired gun for Greenpeace. You never will. But you'll never appeal to the tiny minority of people who sort of are Gaia Earth worshippers who believe that human beings are a cancer on the planet. Uh-huh. You'll never get them. But 95% of environmentalists are just well-meaning people. In fact, they're not bad. They're the opposite of bad. They're do-gooders.
Right.
They just so dearly want to make the world better. They just are going about it the wrong way. Let me whip through my other
three. Oh, yeah, sure.
I'll just be super quick, but I just want to show you how we are the best oil in the world.
Yes.
I talked about the environment. I could spend a lot of time on this issue, but I want to touch on the other three. Peace. Look, we're the guys who invented peacekeeping. The Saudis invented 9/11. I mean, 15 out of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Iran is using their oil revenues to build a nuclear bomb. Venezuela is using its oil money to threaten its neighbor, Colombia. Russia is using its oil money to re-equip the new KGB called the FSB and to invade Georgia. I mean, we are the only peaceful guys in the top 10 list. How about my third criteria, fair wages? As you guys know, you can drive a pickup, you can drive a dump truck or a bus in Fort McMurray and make $100,000 a year. I met a cook the other day who's making $80,000 a year, like a short order cook. $80,000. That's as much as some doctors make. Fort McMurray's the richest city in Canada, and according to the United Way, it's the most generous city in Canada, and according to Statistics Canada, the working poor, like the people making the lowest quarter of income in Fort McMurray, have so much more purchasing power than if you're poor anywhere else in the world. If you've got to be poor in Canada, get thee to Fort McMurray. Compare that with Nigeria.
But wait a minute, Ezra. Aren't those unfair wages?
Good point. Yeah, they're so rich, they're unfair. Good point.
Hey, you know, and I just like to add to that on the economic justice point of view here. You certainly have to look at all the government revenues, provincially and federally, that flow from the exploitation. Utilization of the oil sands, this rich deposit there, and all the good, if you're a good liberal and believe in good government programs to fight poverty.
Good Canadian.
You're a good Canadian to fight poverty and to provide services, women's transition houses and shelters for the homeless and welfare and all that sort of stuff. Where do you think that money comes from?
You're so right. I was in Halifax last week, and there was a union guy there who is involved with recruiting people from Cape Breton to work in the oil sands. Cape Breton, when I was a kid, was synonymous with unemployment. This fella told me that every week between $3 and $6 million net flows into Cape Breton from the oil sands, just from the union jobs alone.
Wow.
$3 to $6 million a week, depending on the season. It's the best thing that ever happened to his community. This guy's a real union guy from Nova Scotia, but he's so proud of the oil sands that has saved the region. Newfoundland, instead of waiting around for a government tags program, these guys are making six-figure checks and loving it. But compare that to Nigeria, where half of people live on less than a dollar a day. Life expectancy is 47. How could that be? Because the government stole it all.
Hmm.
What's my final criteria? Respect for minorities. Here's a point for you. The mayor of Fort McMurray is a young woman named Melissa Blake. Completely unremarkable in Canada to have a woman as a mayor. I mean, so commonplace, we don't even notice it. How many young women mayors are there in Saudi Arabia? Zero. It's against the law. It's against the law for women to vote there. It's against the law for women to drive. And Melissa Blake, it happens to be divorced and is living with her fiance and yada yada, again, completely normal here. In Iran, another oil producer, that would be against Sharia law. That would be called adultery, and she would be stoned to death. How about Aboriginals? The oil sands employ more Aboriginal people than any other industry in Canada. Compare that to how Hugo Chavez treats Aboriginals if they get in his way. He just brushes them off the land, and if they fight back, he kills them. How about gays? Well, if you ask Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, there are no gays in Iran. And it's true in a way because they're executed if they're found. I mean, we don't think about our oil sands oil as feminist oil or gay rights oil or Aboriginal rights oil or peacekeeping oil or fair wage oil. We just don't think of it that way. But it is. And so I put to you using these four liberal measures, the environment, including carbon dioxide, peace, economic justice, and human rights, taken together, we are the fair trade coffee of the world's oil industry.
Very well put. But you know what, Ezra? Every week now, for the last couple of weeks, we've seen the litany, the unrelenting...
Dead duck soup.
Dead ducks. Or dead waterfowl.
Right. I note...
Put that into context for us, will you?
I sure will. You know, I don't know if you saw the news, but Kentucky Fried Chicken's new double down sandwich, the two pieces of chicken without any bread.
Yes.
Amazing invention that the scientists used to create.
Stop. Wait, you got to stop, Ezra. I have to. That sandwich has caused more discussion on more fronts than any other topic.
And now
I've
it's coming up again.
And here Ezra, the logical, practical
Because they're slaughtering all these chickens to make that.
Yeah, I mean, how many chickens, how many birds a day go in? 300,000. There were 300,000 double downs sold in the first month in Canada. I mean, how many ducks are killed in a dim sum in Vancouver on any given Sunday?
And slathered in oil.
How many ducks are hunted by good old boys? How many ducks or other birds are electrocuted by high voltage wires? How many birds have flown into the window of your house? According to the Wind Energy Association, a billion birds a year die just from house cats in North America.
Like only Ezra would know that statistic.
You know what I want to know? How many birds die every year flying into the windows of Greenpeace offices around the world? Let's calculate how many Greenpeace offices there are, how many windows they have, what the average bird kill per window per annum is, and let's find out what the tally is, the devastation caused by Greenpeace existing.
Well, don't laugh. I mean, Margaret Atwood and I don't have a lot in common, but the one thing we're both worried about is the number of birds killed by windmills, these big wind turbines. And it's not just little birds like ducks. It's endangered birds, especially in the Altamont region, where it kills condors and big eagles. You know, one of the saddest things I ever saw was a YouTube video of these great big birds of prey circling these windmills almost in a trance and going into their death. I read about a windmill in the UK that was set up at a school as sort of a symbol of environmentalism. They took it down because the kids were traumatized by all the dead birds that would be at the bottom of it every morning. Look, I'm not happy about these dead birds dying. I mean, we kill birds for sport. We kill birds for food. Other animals kill birds. Birds die by accident. But we shouldn't be happy that 230 birds died last week by accident in a freak ice storm. But you know what? Those 230 birds, I'm not going to use the word tragedy because I need the word tragedy to keep that word precious, like a sharp knife that I don't use too frequently, for when I really need it, like when Sudan kills 300,000 people in Darfur on purpose, not by accident, murdered, and oil's part of the equation there, because Sudan's a booming oil producer. China buys a lot of its oil from Sudan. And I actually worked it out, 300,000 people murdered in Darfur times 185 ounces of blood per human body, divided into the number of barrels of oil exported by Sudan over the same period of time, it works out to 6.5 milliliters of human blood for every single barrel of oil. That's about as much blood as you could fit in a lipstick tube. It's probably like an eyeball's worth or a big toe's worth in every barrel. So yes, mea culpa. We killed a few ducks by accident when the electric scarecrow wasn't working. Yes, it happened. But yes, 300,000 Darfuris were murdered on purpose. So if we're judging oil versus oil, OPEC versus the oil sands, which oil do you want in your car? And so when Nancy Pelosi or Barack Obama come up here and wag their fingers at us, or James Cameron jets up here and says, oh, you dirty oil sands, the answer isn't to be defensive. It's to say, oh, yeah? What's in your gas tank, Nancy?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's not even the foreign interlopers, and we talked earlier about the foreign charities and their eco-imperialism, as I call it. I probably didn't coin that phrase, but I love it. But it's also Canadians themselves and political leaders. Do you remember, of course, how can you forget, the grandstanding that took place last autumn in Copenhagen, by Canadian politicians trying to push for global warming initiatives, and a lot of their sort of grandstanding was based on their opposition to the oil sands.
Yeah, let me remind folks that carbon dioxide in oil, about for every liter of gas, about 20% of the carbon dioxide is released in the producing and refining of it. But 80% of it's released burning it in your car. So all these folks from Dalton McGuinty and Jean Charest from Ontario and Quebec, where do they think the oil is being burned? Why do they think it's being produced? It's for them. It's their cities. And, you know, oil isn't being produced just for fun. It's because people in Toronto and Montreal like to drive around and jet around and heat their homes. And by the way, I calculated the number of jobs in Ontario working for the oil sands from Ontario, mainly on Bay Street on the financial side,
yeah,
and in other parts of Ontario on the heavy industry manufacturing side. There are more people in Ontario working for the oil sands from Ontario than are in Ontario working for the big three automakers. In fact, if you were to shut down the oil sands today, God forbid, unemployment in Ontario would rise by almost 0.5%. And so I think Alberta has to do a better job of saying to all these people in Ontario, in Quebec, in Newfoundland, hey, this is a national resource. In fact, the oil sands are, I put it to you, that they're a source of national unity. I mean, every region in this country benefits not just through the taxes that you mentioned earlier, but through direct jobs and indirect jobs. I mean, it is the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. And we Canadians are so modest and so humble that we don't toot our own horn. And that's a great characteristic in an individual person to show humility and modesty, and one day I'll know what it feels like if I ever feel that.
When you're laid low by something. You want to bet on that one, Terry?
Oh, it'll happen one day. Sure
but
will.
For a country that's competing against the world's dictators and fascists and bomb makers and thugs, modesty is not an attribute. We need to be proud. And in fact, I've got an idea in the book that, and it's something that, I don't know, it seems so obvious to me. It's called country of origin labeling. Every item of clothes you're wearing, every toy you buy at Toys R Us, everything in our consumer society says where it's made. And sometimes it doesn't matter. We just want the cheapest thing. But sometimes it does matter. I mean, would you buy baby food or toothpaste made in China? Probably not. Well, how come our gasoline does not have country of origin labeling? I mean, especially in America, the most consumer rights country in the world. Well, I know why. Because if one pump handle said made in Saudi Arabia, and another said made in Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and the third said made in Canada, no one would want to buy those first two pumps full of oil. And so those refineries would be in a pickle. And I put it to you that if we simply had country of origin labeling, people would buy Canadian ethical oil, conflict-free oil, dictatorship-free oil. They might even pay a premium for it. People pay an extra buck a cup for premium ethical coffee. We could probably even charge a few extra pennies a gallon. And it would be such a wonderful thing. It would create consumer demand, and the refineries would want to shift over to Canadian oil, and it would put pressure on the OPEC countries to improve their conduct.
Yeah.
Because maybe they would be told, oh, sorry, we can't buy your Nigerian oil anymore because you're too brutal, and we're certified, you know, 100% dictatorship-free oil, or we have a rule no more than 5% oil from terrorist states or something.
Well, you know, these ideas make so much sense. You would think that some of these people who are involved in these activist groups would embrace these, but of course it's not convenient for them. It's much easier for them to raise money, get the money from the U.S., and to sort of target what's convenient, what people... what's close to home, and people don't want bad things happening in their backyard and stuff like that. So it's all part of this viral machine.
Exactly.
This is a lead into a question, Ezra, and you know, we're trying to expect reasonableness from some of the opponents to the oil sands. I believe that you had a debate with the leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May. Did she get any of this? Did you change
her
mind?
She's slightly more reasonable than Greenpeace is. Greenpeace, I mean, they're like robots. They're like Terminators. They will never, ever, ever admit anything, because if they were ever to admit that Canadian oil is morally superior than Saudi oil, things flow logically from that, like, well, maybe America should buy more of our oil and less Saudi oil, and Greenpeace would never countenance that. So I've actually debated five different Greenpeace lobbyists, and each one of them has the same talking point. They refuse to say that we're better than Saudi Arabia or Iran. It's actually quite a bizarre thing when they just will not admit that we're morally better.
Well, what is their position, though, Ezra? What do they say? Obviously, you confront them with that. How do they respond to that?
They say, oh, who are we to judge? Who knew that Greenpeace was not about judging things anymore? They sure forgot about the peace part of Greenpeace.
Greenpeace doesn't want to judge?
Who are we to judge?
I'm not even kidding.
One of the most judgmental organizations in the history of Western civilization, Greenpeace. Who are we to judge? Let me tell you,
incredible.
We're going to judge them. And we're going to sentence them to 10 years of purgatory somewhere. Mike, take away their money. Defund those guys. And how many birds have died in the windows of Greenpeace offices? That's what I want to know. My goodness, Ezra. You're getting me all worked up here.
More reasonable than that. And she does have to think about votes. And, so for example, she probably realizes that calling for the shutdown of the oil sands means a lot of people out of work, and that would be bad for her as a politician. But I was debating her. I've debated her about four times already, believe it or not, and more to come. On the Roy Green show, Roy Green asked her if she thought that the oil sands were a net positive or a net negative for Canada. She wouldn't answer that. She could not bring herself to say that the oil sands are a net blessing. You know,
bring back the waffle party. She can join that one.
Yeah. You know what, though? Again, those aren't the people I'm trying to convince. Let me tell you that I have had such a warm reception by true liberals in this country. They're surprised by these arguments, and they're not ready for them, and they've never heard them before. And I appeal to their values. I don't challenge or deny their values. I appeal to them. You know me. I'm a global warming skeptic. And I say that because I want to be honest. But then I spend the next 10 minutes showing how oil sands oil has a lower carbon footprint than these other sources. And so I'm actually appealing to their values and counting on their honor, not disputing it. And the Toronto Star gave this book a very favorable review. Even Gian Gomeshi of CBC's radio show Q was surprisingly friendly, because I just don't think he had thought this through before. And I think it takes someone to point out, when Greenpeace says, well, in 40 years we'll have some new technology, that may or may not come true, but we got to fill up our gas tanks this week, so what do we put in it? And, some folks in Greenpeace will say, well, that's the problem. We're all burning gas. We got to get off fossil fuels. Okay, why don't you go tell China and India, as you said, be an eco-imperialist, a green imperialist, and tell them, we can drive, we can heat our homes in the winter, we can have an energy-intensive lifestyle, but they have to still go around, without vehicles. That's where all the energy growth in the world is coming from, is China and India, not from America, which is pretty much stable.
You know, Ezra, this whole discussion reminds me a little bit of something that happened years ago on my farm. I have an organic farm, and when my kids were little, of course, the schools would come out because we had the chickens and we had the turkeys. And we had the milk cow. And I remember one time, because we always gave the milking the cow a description, and we were in the kitchen, straining the milk and putting it in the jars, dare I say raw milk nowadays with
I won't get the police on you, don't worry.
Anyway, this one little girl I can still picture in my mind's eye to this day, she pipes up and she says, as I'm pouring the milk into the jar, Mrs. Simpson, we don't get our milk from a cow. We get it from Safeway. and which leads me to think, is our educational system so deficient in understanding the broader picture of oil production and gas production and economic use and all the rest of it? Like, has your book become mandatory reading in the public education system?
Let me
yet?
Just add a little caveat to that. We have all these social justice courses in British Columbia that are being taught throughout grade 12s. They're optional courses and highly controversial.
Perfect study.
This is perfect. Your book should be on the curriculum, Ezra.
Well, let me give you a fact that I found out only after I finished the book, which is just staggering to me. The total carbon dioxide output of all the oil sands combined, there's about 100 companies up there, is, let's call it 30 or 35 megatons a year. Now, anything with the word mega in it sounds pretty big, but Canada's annual emissions are about 700 megatons. So this is about 5% of the Canadian total, and Canada is only 2% of the world's total. So the oil sands are 0.1%. But here's the thing. There are
enough to get you taken off the road if that's your blood alcohol level here in BC, so it must be pretty significant. Anyway.
There are individual coal-fired power stations in China, a single power plant, that have more emissions than all the oil sands put together. In fact, there's half a dozen Chinese power plants alone, let alone Taiwan and Korea and Russia, that have 35, 40, even 42 megatons of CO2 in one power plant. And China is building two or three new coal-fired power plants a week. There are underground coal mine fires in China. You know, a coal mine fire can burn for 100 years. Mm.
Right.
There are the coal mine fires in China emit 360 megatons of CO2 a year. So every month, just what they burn in coal by accident in China is more than all the oil sands combined. Single power plants emit more than all the oil sands combined. So when people are worried about global warming, I say, hey, which is the bigger threat, China or oil sands, which are so much more efficient than anyone else? And there's all these other values like peace and economic justice and human rights. I mean, I think that liberals just have to be shown that if they're going to be true to their values, they've got to do more than just rehearse the cliches and the slogans. And Greenpeace is very, very, very brave about breaking into the refineries in Fort McMurray and unfurling their posters because they know they will not be shot. If you break into a refinery in Iran or Saudi Arabia or even post 9/11 America, you will be shot. And it's ironic that the most gentle country in the world gets Greenpeace's most vigorous attack, but the brutal butchers of the world, Greenpeace is afraid to even go there.
Wow.
And, hey, I get it. I wouldn't want to be killed either. But they don't even bother putting out a press release because there's no fundraising angle in it.
Right. And what you're suggesting is that Greenpeace is maybe showing a little bit of activist cowardice there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Greenpeace,
maybe
you
should
know
be
how
green,
they
yellow.
A
little bit of yellow.
They sailed out in a little boat.
Yeah.
To confront the U.S. Navy that was going to detonate a nuclear bomb off the coast. I mean, whatever you think of the wisdom of that, those guys had guts. They
yeah.
had guts.
Yeah.
And they stood for both the green and the peace.
Right.
Now Greenpeace is run out of Europe. It's a multinational corporation with annual revenues of over $250 million a year.
Right, and how many birds have they killed this year?
well, and the thing is...
Ezra, before we're running out of time here, and I know that and some of our more skeptical listeners and some of the people in the audience might be thinking, this man sounds like he's on the payroll of the Alberta oil industry, or a Bay Street with all the oil shares and stuff. And then this book is paid and bought before he's even start to come up with this conclusion. Ezra, what's the answer to that?
Well, I came up with this book idea when I was on tour for my last book, Shakedown, and at an Ottawa Writers Festival, they said, oh, there's some guy talking about the oil sands. You're from Alberta. Go down and make it a panel. So literally, they threw me in this room, and I was faced with 100 liberal Ontarians who were asking all these tough questions, but they were sort of dumb questions, and it was like 100 versus 1. And I left there with my notes. I thought, oh, my God, I've got a book here, because these are not evil people. They're just really misled. I sent it to my publisher, McLellan & Stewart, and they said, you got a book deal. Here's $13,000 as an advance. We'll pay another $13 upon delivery and $13 when we publish it. So after my agent took his cut, I made about $34,000 on the book. It was all from a liberal publishing house called McLellan & Stewart, same guys who published Margaret Atwood. And the funny thing is, I've been touring with the book for 6 weeks. I haven't done a single oil company event. I did a speech at the Petroleum Club. But the irony is, that, I mean, I thought this book would be a huge hit with the oil companies, but I've only been doing book events, whereas people on the other side, like Andrew Nikiforuk, I've discovered, is on the Greenpeace payroll. So you would think, yeah, an author who has a pro-oil message, he'd be on the payroll of oil companies. I haven't received a dime from them. Not that I was expecting it. I mean, my publisher took care of me, as I told you.
Yeah.
But the irony is that the Greenpeace side, they're the ones getting the payola. I interviewed Andrew Nikiforuk. He's a pretty good journalist, but he's so critical of the oil sands, and he praises Greenpeace so much. And I found out he took money from them and took free trips and was part of their lobbying team. And I asked him about that, and he was so outraged that he said these are questions that, quote, a Nazi would ask. I said,
what?
No, Andrew. They're just questions about conflict of interest and journalistic ethics. And I discovered that he was a CBC environmentalist commentator commenting on the Greenpeace lobbying trip to Norway to get Statoil to divest from the oil sands. He was part of the Greenpeace delegation. He reported on the delegation without saying he was part of it. So there he was in Norway and on the CBC reporting boat, and Greenpeace did this and Greenpeace did that. No, Andrew, you did that. You were part of them, but he never told his audience. He never tells Globe and Mail or Report on Business that he takes cash from Greenpeace. It's staggering to me, but you know what? That is normal for the anti-oil sands side. They're extremely well-funded, whereas oil companies are very limited in what they do because they're public companies and their finances are subject to shareholder scrutiny.
And I'm
not saying that I would like to be bought off by an oil company. I value my independence and my credibility more than I value a few dollars. But it's so ironic that someone who asks liberal questions and wants to criticize Iran and Saudi Arabia as well as criticize. By the way, I believe in criticizing the oil sands. I think that's why we're one of the ways Canada's such a great country, because we're always so self-critical and self-improving, and we allow dissidents. We don't kill them like Russia does or Iran does. So I actually like Andrew Nikiforuk, and although I think he's sort of a bad faith dealer because he's taking cash from Greenpeace. I think he's part of the healthy debate, but it's a little bit much when he calls us Saudi Alberta, because there really is a Saudi Arabia out there, and we're nothing like it.
Yeah. And the sort of, I've seen this attitude that Nikiforuk displays, I've seen it before among environmentalists who are left-wing or liberal activists who think that their cause is so holy and so righteous that they sort of are above the normal boundaries of ethical conduct. They can, and actually there was a survey done about, an attitudinal survey done last year about this very thing. People who have these holier-than-thou attitudes towards the environment or human rights are less bothered and are more likely to do things like, less bothered by, are more likely to do things like shoplift or tell little lies and things like that. Because they don't think they're held to the same standards because they're so holy and righteous and other things that these little things don't really matter.
Oh, that's a trade-off.
And there's actually been a study about that, Ezra. So maybe it'll help you understand where he comes from. Yet it's quite something. So, you know, I gobsmacked you, did I?
Well, it sounds like you're describing David Suzuki to me. I mean, okay. A man with an enormous carbon footprint. When he came to Calgary, he rented a big diesel bus for his tour, and he left it running the whole time he was inside giving a speech for over an hour. But he's a great man. Allow him to do that. Or James Cameron, who came up here to lecture us on the oil sands, he went on a 107-city PR tour for Avatar. Now, I'm not saying that those are evil things. I'm just saying they don't actually believe in the environment enough to change their own lifestyles. To them, it's about publicity and being the hero and making a lot of money. David Suzuki, if I recall that piece that Ms. Krause did, has received over $10 million for his lobbying from American donors. He's gotten rich off it. He's a celebrity millionaire. That's what drives him as much as any do-goodery.
And what does he think about human beings from that video, that YouTube clip that you have on your website?
Oh, that's right. You know, I got this old clip. I put it up on my website once or twice. It's him from the real hippie eras in the 70s comparing humans to maggots. And he says, oh, the more we acquire, we're just a second or third or fourth level maggot.
Yeah, I think, I think we made it
David,
to 10th level.
Speak for yourself. I'm a person, and I'm not a maggot. And if I want to earn a living to take care of my family, that doesn't make me a ninth level maggot. That's the kind of talk he had there.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's become that maggot that he used to criticize. He's got five homes. He jets around, you know, a millionaire lifestyle. And I'm not saying those are evil things, but he is. And I don't know. Look, you'll never convince him otherwise. I mean, you'd have to come with even more money. You'd have to say, David, I can pay you $10 for every one the left does to buy you over. Maybe that would win him over. But you don't have to do that for normal people. Normal, good faith liberals who are do-gooders, if you talk their language and talk their values, the oil sands can win the argument on their own. You don't have to bribe people. I'm coming out to Vancouver, actually, on November, I think it's 17th
I
or
think
18th.
That's right,
November
yeah.
18th.
Yeah.
I'm debating at SFU. I think that's the location. Against Ben West, who's sort of a real hippie activist against the oil sands and oil tankers. He's bringing 400 of his friends out. I don't think there's going to be a soul in that room at the beginning on my side. Perfect.
Yeah.
I bet you.
Yeah,
I don't want
you.
To speak to allies. I don't want to speak to friends.
Yeah.
I don't want to speak to people who already agree with your all sense. I want Ben to bring 400 of his friends because I think I can win 100 or 200 of them over. Not the ones like Ben who make a living out of being angry at oil, but the good faith followers who just think Ben's told them everything. They're going to hear some new things that day. I'm going to take a vote at the beginning to see who's on my side, and then I'll take a vote at the end. And I bet you I'll turn some minds around.
Good for you. The book is Ethical Oil. The author is Ezra Levant. The website is ezralevant.com. The bookstores are all across Canada. And get your copy. I urge you to do so. It's been a consistent top seller, and it deserves to be so. Ezra, I remember talking about this book with you when it was when it was a twinkle in your eye, and I'm so pleased that it's published and having such a great reaction and making a positive impact for Canada. That's what we need. Congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us on Roadkill Radio tonight.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Always good fun, Ezra. Good night.
Good night, Ezra. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.